Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 342nd episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia in Canada.
Forgot where you were there briefly. Yeah,
I thought I'd switch it up so people know that BC is in Canada.
Okay, that was awesome. Thanks for the geography lesson. I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and a professor with the University of Alberta. And today we're going to do a not-so-premium podcast.
No, but I'm shaking all over for this one, Mike.
I'm sure you are, because there's a couple of good topics here. So we're going to try and deal with a little bit. There was a very popular study. We just did the PCSK9s as a premium podcast, yeah. And for those of you who are premium members, you can tune into that. There's other PCSK9 results that came out, not nearly as compelling as the evolocumab study, which we covered.
I'm not sure I would say the other ones were compelling anyway.
Yeah. It's a compelling by comparison.
Yes.
By comparison.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's all about comparisons, James. You mm-hmm. can't just take things out of context. So, but we encourage you to go listen to that, or as many of you do, steal a membership from others.
Oh, you. So true. That you should
we
never
are.
Say.
We are joking. Absolutely. So. But let's get on to some other new studies that we think are relevant, some that go back a few months because we just haven't had a chance to get to them, mm-hmm. and some that are very new. Let's deal with the newest one here first, and that is one that came out just in the last week in the BMJ, and it was around vitamin D for respiratory tract infections. So this is upper or lower respiratory tract infections. And just to give you a glimpse at some of the headlines from media, there is now compelling evidence that vitamin D helps prevent colds and flus. And at the same time, while that makes up the majority of the media reports, there were media reports that said, don't believe the hype, vitamin D supplements unlikely to prevent chest infections. So then let's jump to, we'll give you what the authors concluded. And just to give you a background, who are these authors? Well, they're all the people who have done or participated in randomized controlled trials of vitamin D in one form or another supplementation to prevent a whole range of respiratory tract infections. So they all got together and shared their data. And we'll talk about how that manifests in a second. But this is their conclusion. Vitamin D supplementation was safe, and it protected against respiratory tract infections overall. Patients who were very vitamin D deficient and those not receiving bolus treatment experienced the most benefit. And not receiving bolus meant that they were receiving daily oral supplements. So what did the editorial say? The editorial said the results were heterogeneous and not sufficiently applicable to general practice. Current evidence does not support the use of vitamin D supplementation to prevent disease, except patients at high risk of osteomalacia. So,
and there is another great example of why patients and healthcare providers must just shake their heads. It's like a circular thing. It works, it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And that's just of the same meta-analysis, which is what this is.
Yeah. So let's talk a tiny bit about this meta-analysis. So as I mentioned, kind of laid the groundwork for who's doing it. There are 25 randomized controlled trials included in this with 11,321 patients. Age was between 0 to 95, and as we'll get to, the preponderance of participants were actually quite young. They did an individual patient meta-analysis that included 24 of the 25 trials, in other words, 10,933 people. Now, they report their adjusted odds ratio of 0.88 with a confidence interval of 0.81 to 96. And that is their primary outcome for all respiratory infections. Now, what's interesting here is, despite that, they don't actually present that metagraph in the results. They only present a further adjusted meta-analysis, which makes it somewhat difficult to interpret. But we will try and delve into what this is. Now, interestingly, you'll say, well, what was the quality of the trials and that kind of thing? Well, if you went and looked up the quality of the trials in the supplement, you would see that the quality of the trials was all rated very, very highly. So how can that happen when every other review of this nature doesn't find the trials to be of very high quality? And that's because when you, let's say, James, you did a trial, and I asked you, did you conceal allocation? What would your answer be?
What does allocation concealment mean?
That's the real answer.
Yeah, no, but it may be worth actually mentioning what that means, because I know students and other people get very confused about that. And so,
so we
can spend a little bit of time. So let's just talk about what allocation concealment is. It basically means it's not blinding. So
Don't ever say that to me.
Yeah, no. It's not blinding, even though everybody who you explain allocation concealment to you goes, is that blinding? No. All it means is that we've got a whole bunch of people and we're going to decide whether they go into group A or group B. What we don't want is the investigators knowing what the next person will go into. So at the time that they're going to... Go ahead.
And directing them in which way, yes, and being allowed to direct them. That's the key thing, because if they know, they'll modify how they're directed.
Yeah. So they may modify it. They don't.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of evidence that they do modify it. There is a suggestion that they could modify it, because if you knew that, you know, one person, the next person was going to get put in the placebo group instead of the drug group, you might encourage them to go into one group or not, and so on and so forth. So what hopefully is done is that it's not a process that the investigator can know anything about, which is where you typically phone up a site, you know, an off-site process where the computer then comes back and says, okay, they go into this one and this one. And that's just the way it works, so that the investigator can't influence it. There is a suggestion that there is an association between studies that do or don't do allocation concealment, that the results are a little bit questionable. I would suggest that it's really a marker. It's not a cause and effect process. So if you were to ask me, was allocation concealment done? Often when you look at the actual study results, or if you look at the methodology, they actually don't mention allocation concealment. So when you do that, it's really, you'd have to report that it was unknown. Because very few people in the study say, nope, didn't do allocation concealment. We knew what was going on.
Yeah, so just to add a little bit to that, so there is some evidence that there's some trials that have actually reported when people weren't adhering to the allocation process. Mm-hmm. So it's, as James said, you generate a random list, and then you have a random list, but it's how patients are allocated to the randomization process that matters, and you need to conceal that allocation, hence the name, from people that are enrolling patients into the trial. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they can. And so there's been a few examples in the past where doctors or clinicians have, there's a great example where they were looking at doing laparoscopic surgery for gallbladders, and they were randomizing patients to open or lap, and the surgeons were actually using the surgical light to hold envelopes up to the light so that they could see which group that was that they were supposed to do next, and then they would reshuffle the envelopes to pick which they wanted.
Yeah. I'm not suggesting that is, you know, what do you call it? Not an old wives' tale, but an urban myth, because I would imagine that happened. I have not seen any evidence that there is a wholesale allocation concealment fraud issue.
Conspiracy?
Yeah, conspiracy.
Yeah.
What I think it is, it's just one of the five or six key markers of quality of trial.
I agree that there's a fairly high chance of that. And James right now is putting back on his tinfoil cap.
Mm-hmm,
to go ahead. But so this is just one of the issues that we would have trouble sorting out unless you actually spoke to the author. Now, are all authors, even if they didn't really do something like have a separate phone line, have envelopes that were dark that you can't see through, most of them are going to say regardless, oh yeah, no, we made sure that the allocation process was hidden from the investigators and from the clinicians. But Yeah, so if you looked at this, you would see that every single quality indicator is perfect in these trials, which is interesting and maybe, call me crazy, a little hard to believe. But let's move on to actual results. So I've explained to you already that the odds ratio was 0.88. Now, many of you would interpret that as a 12% reduction in the risk of developing respiratory tract infections. But the little caveat here that's important to understand is that an odds ratio can't be interpreted like that, especially when there are when the events that are being studied are common. Mm-hmm. And seeing how this includes flus and colds, and if I'm not mistaken, James, the cold is often called the common cold.
Yeah, yeah.
So it might be common.
You think so?
And sometimes, I'm just throwing it out there, okay, as a possibility.
Yeah.
So what we did is we took these numbers and redid them in relative risk format, and the number changes from 0.88 to 0.96 with a confidence interval of 0.91 to 1.00. Mm-hmm. So whether that's statistically significant or not, I don't really care.
Yeah,
it's more of a 4% reduction instead of a 12% reduction.
And the reason that we do that is just exactly as you said, is when the event rate is below 10% overall, odds ratios and relative risk, now this is getting very nerdy, but are very, very, very similar. And so we don't care.
Wait a minute, just a second. This is getting very nerdy.
Yes.
I want you to go back to podcast one.
we're just jacking up the nerdiness is all I'm saying. I didn't say we didn't start off nerdy, but...
Okay, yeah, because so, people live in that for years.
And so, in fact, many people suggest that you should never use odds ratios, period, because it's not how clinicians really think, right? We just think of, the relative difference between the groups. So what percent happened in one group versus the other group, not odds of something happening. I mean, I guess if you are, if you're a vet, you might use odds ratios because, when you're used to horse racing, odds are really good.
That's right. But once again, drawing in sports analogies.
Yeah. Well, and I do know that we have vets that listen to this podcast, but the vast majority are not vets. And and so in this...
Or they're vets.
Yeah. And so because the upper respiratory tract infection rate in the arms was, 40% plus, that's probably why they used an odds ratio. And that's why it gets a bit confusing. So anyway, I think you guys did the reanalysis in a way that makes more sense to clinicians.
Right. So it's about a 4% relative reduction. And then even more important, and I think you'll agree, James, mm-hmm. is what are the actual numbers? Mm-hmm. And so just as you indicated, you're talking about a 40% risk having a respiratory infection of some type versus a 42% risk. So... that's for taking these for at least one cold season or one, winter type season. And let's talk a little bit now about what the editorial raised, which is the heterogeneity. So mm-hmm. it's a 53% heterogeneity score, which is considered statistically significant. And Cochrane would define that as at risk of substantial heterogeneity. And what does that mean? Well, that means that if you were to look at this metagraph of 24 different studies, there's a lot of studies that don't overlap well. Even their confidence intervals aren't touching one another or wouldn't overlap, meaning that they're finding very different results. And so that then leads you to the question of, well, why are they finding different results and are they studying different things? Well, just to give you some context for that, one of the first studies mentioned in the meta-analysis is a U.S. study of healthy kind of 59-year-old people, and they studied any respiratory tract infection. One of the next groups is from Afghanistan, and they were 0 to 3-year-olds from a poor area of Kabul, Afghanistan, and they were examining pneumonias only.
But that's the same as the first one.
Yeah, very similar. So the next group, because they found a positive result in that trial, they decided to repeat it with a broader sample, a larger sample of 0 to 1-year-olds, again in Kabul, Afghanistan, and this time it found absolutely no effect. In fact, the intervention had slightly more. So even within, even when they're repeating in the same populations, in the same areas, the same dosing, you're getting completely different results. Probably the one that has the best results is by Carmargo, I think is the name. And in that study, it was a study of Mongolian children. And they looked at any respiratory tract infections. This wasn't pills. It was actually a vitamin D solution mixed in with a milk type drink for these kids. Their baseline levels, the vast majority don't even measure baseline, but the baseline levels in this study were 17.5. Which is exceptionally low given that the kind of cutoff we're looking at is somewhere between 30 and 50 for adequate, according to the Institute of Medicine. So 17.5, that's the lowest that I know of for a baseline level. And it's actually, and they found the best effect. So that might be, and in fact, when we did the tools for practice, we said there may be some advantages, particularly in the developing world where levels are actually low.
So, and the last one I'll mention is another... You're not saying if someone actually has a vitamin D deficiency, giving vitamin D is a benefit?
I know. Crazy, isn't it? Absolutely crazy. The last one I'll mention is a New Zealand study that looked at university workers. Mean age was 47. They were also some healthcare workers, and they looked only at common colds as outcomes. So comparing pneumonia in infants to working adults in New Zealand, you know, it's such a terrible mishmash of studies. So when you look at some of these subgroups, like for example, the proportion of patients that represent this meta-analysis that are under age one are over 50%. So there's a lot of things that kind of become hard to figure out how you would apply this in a regular practice. But I would say that they did look at patients, because they could get to individual patient level data, they looked at patients whose mean vitamin D level was less than 25. Mm-hmm. And that accounted for a small fraction of the patients. Because first of all, over 50% of these studies never check vitamin D levels. But of those that did, there were a number that had levels that were less than 25. So how many? Somewhere about 500 patients out of somewhere around 4,000 or 4,500 actually had a level less than 25. So a small proportion. But in those, they seem to get the greatest benefit, just as you were kind of joking about, James. What about the dosing? Well, it seems like those who got the best reduction, they got about an odds ratio of 0.8 versus an odds ratio of 0.9 or 0.98. The 0.8 group were the ones who got low dose vitamin D, 800 international units or less. And then whether you got bolus, if you got bolus, your odds ratio was 0.97 versus if you were given it in the regular doses, yours was 0.81 odd ratio. What does all this mean?
Here's what it means is you can torture the data till it confesses.
Right. So, but if you were a guessing person, runs very counter to this idea of giving everyone vitamin D. Mm-hmm. Vitamin D should be given to those who are very low levels, which is, even though we want to believe it to be true, it's extraordinarily rare here in mm-hmm. Canada and elsewhere to be less than 25. The average for Canadians, 14% of Canadians have a level less than 40 at one point in the year. Mm-hmm. So less than 25 is even less frequent.
That, yeah.
Yeah. Daily dose given at around 800 international units to people with very low levels, like less than 25, they might get a benefit. But the average person in Canada or North America and in the developing or the developed world, it's improbable they're going to get a benefit from this.
Yeah.
And I know that flies in the face of many belief systems. But it's just the unfortunate truth.
Yeah.
And if you look at this metagraph, and I encourage you to get it, it's freely accessible. Most of the effects that are seen, where you see a benefit, are in the small trials. with 24 people per arm, maybe up to 100 people per arm. But if you look at the big trials of like 1,500 per arm or 1,000 per arm, there's no effect anymore. So
and this is, I think, I'm not saying that this is not a useful meta-analysis, but for those of you, just a little bit of history lesson, meta-analyses, I think, started back in like the mid-1970s. And some people suggested it's just the whole concept is just an exercise in mega silliness, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, that you know, the sort of the garbage in equals garbage out, which is why it's so important for people like you or us or whatever to look into the detail of what you've just done when you're looking at a meta-analysis, because all we're hearing in the news is it helps for respiratory tract infections. And, you know, I don't think any reasonable evidence appraisal person would look at this and say, oh yeah, there you go. Proof that we have. It's just not there.
Once you start dissecting it, looking at, okay, they're using odds ratios. Who's actually in this meta-analysis? What is actually going on in this study? You quickly start to unravel some very important bits that lead to skepticism about what we're finding, right?
I would suggest that it barely is hypothesis generating.
Yeah. You know? Well, in fact, that's what these guys say. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, it's going to take big trials and not these small little trials anymore. And it's going to take looking at vitamin D levels at the start and seeing, looking at the different, like enrolling patients who are low and seeing if that benefits them. We've had lots of look at people who are probably high or high, and it doesn't seem to work in them. So let's focus on those. We should prove it in those who are low.
Yeah. And that's where that might be one indication to do another vitamin D study. But as you know, there are many people who've done meta-analyses of vitamin D who've begged people to stop doing studies of vitamin D because we've done so many of them. We know now the one study that probably has not been done, as exactly as you're saying, is in people who are truly vitamin D deficient. Does giving them vitamin D reduce, I guess, respiratory tract infections? But if they're truly vitamin D deficient, we should probably, you know what we should do, Mike? Give them vitamin D.
I know, or any sounds vitamin crazy. For that matter, sounds if crazy. You're deficient in vitamins. Yeah, I know, it's insane.
Yeah.
So, and the frequency of real vitamin deficiency in places like Canada is like 1-2%. So, it's just unfortunate. But let's move on.
I was just going to say, it doesn't change what we have said previously about vitamin D really in any way, shape, or form.
No, not really. Unfortunately, I'd love a panacea, but we're not there yet.
Yeah.
But we do have one for maybe essential tremor. That's saying panacea is a little bit strong, but this is a fascinating study published in New England Journal. It only had 76 patients. So it's really a landmark study. So at least this is more than hypothesis generating. We need another large trial like this. So this is of essential tremor, and these are people with quite profound essential tremor where it would limit, it reduces their quality of life, that kind of thing. And what they did is they took, these are mean age 71 and 68% male, and they did an ultrasound focused thalmotomy. So in other words, they're kind of burning the thalamus in the brain with ultrasound, damaging it. In a very focused way versus sham ultrasound therapy. And these people started out with a mean score of 18 out of 32 on hand tremor. Now, many of us will have no clue about hand tremor scores, but suffice to say that is quite severe. And this is just classic kind of essential tremor. And these patients were enrolled. They had to be on at least two medicines. At least one of those two medicines had to be a first line agent, which was propranolol or primidone, I think is how you say it, James, but you'll correct me. And they had to be, as I mentioned the one scale, but they had to have at least moderate level essential tremor on two different scales. So they were really, I think they did a great job in this study. They actually went the extra mile. They blinded neurologists and they videotaped the patients, and then they gave the videotapes to blinded neurologists So who did the meaning that they weren't blinded, but no. that they couldn't tell what groups were what. And they showed them the videos and said, you know, what do you think of this person's essential tremor? And they had the people doing tasks. Sometimes they were just resting. Sometimes they were doing different activities that would accentuate their tremors. So really well thought out. So what happened in the trial? Well, at 3 months, there was no change with the sham treatments. But in the thalmotomy group, there was a mean reduction of tremor by 47% at 3 months. And that persisted at 12 months with a 40% reduction from baseline. Mm. So this is, you know...
So it was clear that this treatment ended up doing something to the tremor. For
yeah,
sure.
it did. An absolutely made a difference. And another tremor score, it was a 40% reduction from baseline. Quality of life scores, all sorts of scores were all statistically and clinically significantly better. Mm-hmm. They really did show a reduction. Disability score, for example, improved 62% from a score of 16.5 down to 6. So lots of really good ways. Now, I told you that they did their best for blinding, but because the treatment was so effective, 95% of patients who were treated knew they were in the treatment group because they were so much better.
You sort of cut out there, but you said 95%.
95%, yeah.
And there was also some harms associated with it, which is how you would also pick up whether you were being treated.
Yeah, exactly. So kind of a paresthesia numbness in the hand in question mm-hmm. occurred in 38% at 3 months and gait disturbance 36. Now, those are big numbers.
Yeah,
and you
totally.
Would say to yourself, you know, that would be limiting me from considering this. Well, first of all, by 12 months, the numbers dropped down to 14 and 9%. So it was a much smaller mm-hmm. number who were impaired, where the benefits persisted to 12 months at a much higher rate. And when patients were asked if they would redo the therapy, I don't have the exact number, but I think virtually all of them said that they would repeat the treatment again
despite the harms. And then they were looking at the, you know, when they looked at the quality of life, it improved. So overall, there's some clear benefit.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. So this is not something that you or I are going to be prescribing in primary care, but mm-hmm. I think we're always seen as kind of people who focus on the negative, but there it's just that a lot of the research isn't very positive about results. In this case, we do have something that I think can in the future, if this persists, make a very big difference for patients with something that can't, you know, we often think of it as such a minor thing, essential tremor, but I have patients who are severely impaired by this, patients who won't go out in public because they're embarrassed about their tremor.
And to give drugs their due, there is some evidence of benefit of using things like, you know, beta blockers and primidone, which is a barbiturate to help relieve it, but it certainly doesn't eliminate it by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, and they're not quite as effective as these intervention. So this is, you know, we're always looking for things that are very positive. I think this has the potential to be that. It would be great to have a follow-up study with the same kind of benefits or similar benefits. And then I think it's kind of something that would need to be, we'd have to start to look at adopting it on a broader level. It's not available where I am right now, but hopefully if we see this, it will be because it's so effective.
Yeah, no, that's cool. So I think we'll just leave it at that for this podcast, because I think we're again at our time limit of where people have not yet quite fallen into a coma.
They're rousable, is what you're saying.
They're rousable. They're rousable. Yes, they still have some essential tremor,
some baseline neurologic functions. But,
exactly.
But yeah.
Yeah. So stuff we need to sell our Best Science Medicine annual course is coming up in Vancouver in April 7th, April 8th, and we would love it if you would attend that course. You can go sign up for it at therapeuticseducation.org, and we would love it if you could spend a couple of days with us going over all this sort of stuff. It's a Shakespearean theme, which we were going to try and have some fun with, And you guys are still doing lots of tools for practice, and those will be coming out on, as always, a regular basis. And I know you were telling me that you're hiring a bunch of new people for your group, so we may even see more productivity coming from you guys.
Well, it would be nice for a change, wouldn't it, James, to see something good come out of our group?
It would be nice, yeah. Because, I mean, you know, I know you don't tell Mike and Tina and all those guys, but you know, you do all the work.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
No. I am totally kidding.
Yeah, that is not quite remotely true. I thought you were going to go with, because we haven't really done a damn thing in years. So
no, I that hurts.
Yeah. Well, you I know. Was really directing it at you.
I know, that's what I mean. It hurts that you think I would say that.
Well, your wife pays me to say these kind of things.
Oh, there we go. Now we go to the wife. Always the lowest common denominator, and I don't mean that about the wife. It's that, you know,
just low... my humor.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
My humor.
Yeah. So, as most people know, when we get to this point, there's absolutely no value in listening anymore. So, thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.